This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. The largest percentage of immigrants to the United States come from Mexico, but migration between Mexico and the U.S. is changing. A study by the Pew Research Center indicates net migration from Mexico has actually ended. Today, as many Mexicans are returning to their native country as those who are leaving for the U.S. And in North Carolina, more families are permanently relocating here rather than traveling for temporary work. It falls to the Consul General of Mexico in Raleigh to advocate for the rights of those families and help them out when he can. Javier Diaz de Leon is pushing for more integration between Mexicans and Americans as the Obama administration considers executive action on immigration reform. Here to talk about his life as a diplomat and the changing image of immigration in North Carolina and elsewhere is Javier Diaz de Leon. Welcome. So good to have you here.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
I want to get a sense of a day in the life of a consul general, and I think maybe a recent visit to a community college in North Carolina might shed some light on how you spend a lot of your time.
Well, yeah, I think it probably does. Last week I was invited very kindly by great folks at Wayne Community College in Goldsboro. So I had a speech, a presentation there to talk about, you know, the relationship between North Carolina and Mexico, and we can, you know, go into that a little bit later on. But so after my speech, after my presentation, which goes mainly on the political-economic relationship, I'm approached by a young man who shyly, you know, comes closer to me and says, you know, I wanted to talk to you because I really want to see if you can help me. I've been here for 15-20 years, I think he said, and my mom is back home. She's not feeling well. She's a little sick. She lives in Mexico, and maybe you can help me bring her here, which is, in a nutshell, the enormous expectation that sometimes exists among the Mexican community here of what we, from the consulate, can we do to solve all sorts of issues for them. Because, of course, we are not in a position to bring people here. It is not our role to get people's get visas to visit or to come to the United States. But that perception is still there, that we are here to solve every single aspect of their lives.
Yet a lot of your day is spent working with Mexicans who are here. What do they bring to you and what can you do? What kinds of issues do they bring to the consul general?
I mean, on a day-to-day basis, at the consulate building, which, by the way, we just moved to a new building here in Raleigh, we received somewhere around 250, 300 people who come to the consulate. Most of them come to get Mexican documents, passports, consular IDs, powers of attorney, birth certificates. So, you know, day to day. A lot of them come to us also to get legal assistance. We are not practicing law in the United States, but we provide referrals and we provide basic information to people on their legal rights. So most of the people who come to the consulate every day come to all these, you know, very wide sort of issues.
Well, when people are here, obviously they're in a different cultural context. Some are here, some are documented, some are not. We talked about there's some 12 million immigrants from Mexico. About half of them are documented. So when they come to you, what are some of the questions they have? What are some of the misconceptions? Some of the information that people have in this country that just might not be accurate.
Well, you know, first of all, I talked about the misconception of what are the extent of the jobs or the things we can do at the consulate. But I always say when I'm approached that and someone asks me, what is the main challenge that immigrants face in Carolina or in the United States? And you could go, you know, we could go on and on, issue by issue. There's a lot of... but it all comes down, I always say, it all comes down to, I used to say lack of information. But lately I've been changing to more like thinking of not lack of information, but misinformation. Mm. They work on a large set of preconceptions on things that affect their day-to-day life, which are usually incorrect or sometimes are misinformed by people who want to take advantage of them.
Like what?
Issues such as their labor rights. A lot of them, especially those who are here undocumented, believe that they have nowhere to go to if their employer is taking advantage of them. If their employer is not paying them the amount of money that they should, if they are being forced to work longer hours than the law, et cetera, et cetera. Issues such as health. Most of the immigrants don't have information about how to take better care of themselves. They don't have information about community resources that are available in community clinics that might be available for them or for their families. They assume that even for children of them who are born in the United States, and by the way, but because of that are American citizens, that those children, because they're children of immigrants, have no rights either. So things like that. Another enormous issue that we tackle a lot is financial education. They make the assumption that because they are immigrants or because they were not born in the United States, for example, they are not, they don't have access to things such as insurance. They don't have access financial services, opening a bank account. And all those things are crucial because that impedes them being able to provide for the future.
Let's get back to those labor rights. I guess if I were here without documentation, I would certainly be afraid to bring any kind of critique or challenge about my employer. What kind of rights does a worker have if they don't have documentation?
Well, I mean, like any person, I mean, the United States has, international commitments and international legislation that establishes basic labor rights for any person who is working in the United States independently of their immigration status. So we have, for example, very strong collaboration with federal and state institutions on the wage and hours division or on the safety, on their occupational safety issues to make sure that, first of all, you know, their wages and their hours are respected. And, of course, if they are the victims of accident at work, they are entitled to compensation, in depending on the area of work. But there are certain industries, of course, there are entitlements to things like housing, for example, in the agricultural area, and basically, you know, the rights that workers have to have a decent and basic working environment in order to provide for their families.
I am talking to the Mexican Consul General to North and South Carolina, Javier Diaz de Leon, today on The State of Things. So a lot of your time is taken up with that, and that's a big part of your job. But you talked about a talk you made about relationships between particularly North and South Carolina and Mexico. What are those business relationships, and what is unique about, say, North Carolina and its relationship to Mexico vis-a-vis the entire United States?
Well, I mean, the uniqueness goes basically, of course, mostly because of the accelerated and the increasingly fast relationship that has been going on between North Carolina and Mexico. To put it in a context, for example, total trade and relationship between North Carolina and Mexico has grown at a yearly rate of 70% in the past 4 or 5 years, which is amazing.
Now, that might mean it started from nearly zero.
It was very low a few years ago. It was very low 20 years ago when NAFTA came into force. And nowadays, 20 years ago, we were talking about a total trade relationship that went around somewhere around $100 million, $150 million both ways. Nowadays, we're talking about $7.3 billion per year.
Trade in what and which way does it go?
It goes mainly on manufacturers, mainly on parts and machinery that comes back and forth between North Carolina and Mexico. Out of that trade relationship, I would say it would be like somewhere around 65% from Mexico to the United States and the other part from the United States to Mexico. Now, the key element to this, I mean, $7.2 billion comes up to somewhere around $20 million per day. We always say that another important issue is that around 180,000 jobs in North Carolina depend on Mexico. And the trade balance is important in the sense of having a better grasp of what we are trading with each other. But what I would like to make sure that we understand very well is what we are trading with each other basically are manufacturing parts, which means basically that we are manufacturing goods together. Some of those goods have a final destination in the North American market, but many of those goods are, you know, produced for third markets in the world. So the key element in this is that our relationship is as manufacturing partners, which is a great story considering that 20 years ago it basically didn't exist.
Are you talking about parts that might be made in North Carolina, shipped to Mexico for parts that are then put together and create the final product, or which way does it go? Are they All parts of the same product, or are we shipping some things to Mexico?
Some products go back and forth during the manufacturing process between North Carolina and Mexico several times. For example, out of any manufactured product produced in Mexico that comes into the United States, 40% of that product is American-made. So you know, labeling a certain product as Mexican or American or Canadian or you know, Chinese in today's economy is increasingly complicated.
Does the state what role does the state have in state policy and the business environment versus U.S. policy and trade policy?
I would say that North Carolina has been very instrumental in promoting a global perception of North Carolina and better position for it to be part in the global market. One thing that few people know is that North Carolina has had an office in Mexico City, a representative office in Mexico City for over 15 years. And it's been, you know, instrumental in generating this important trade relationship.
Well, we'll talk about who benefits and more about the trade relationship, immigration, and what it takes to be a consul general when we talk to the Mexican consul general, Javier Diaz de Leon, my guest this hour on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Today, talking with Javier Diaz de Leon, Consul General of Mexico to North and South Carolina. His office is in Raleigh. He does a lot of traveling up and down the various interstate corridors that take him between those two states and back to Mexico. Tell us about growing up. I want to find out how one becomes a consul general and why. So take us back to your earliest days in Mexico City. What was that like?
I grew up in Mexico City. I would probably, you know, describe my family as sort of average middle class family in Mexico City. And I would probably say that my parents were among a lot of people in that, you know, sector of population that increasingly saw that the future involved generating for their children an education that was prepared to be part of an international setting or more like. So what I'm talking about is basically is that a lot of me and my peers started going to schools that involved English, you know, core English as part of the core education for the kids. And I learned to write read and write in English in a school in Mexico City, which was at that point was pretty unusual, but now it's not so unusual anymore.
So were you thinking about a life, a diplomatic career, or just generally you knew you were growing up in an increasingly global world?
Well, when I was very little, my mom's brother was a part of the diplomatic service. He was a diplomat. So, you know, he would be living in these exotic places when I was a kid, and I would sometimes go visit my maternal grandparents, and I would find him at home. And he would always have an exotic or exciting story to tell. So I think that probably, you know, created a big dent.
Did he bring back things from other places?
He always did, you know. I remember these gorgeous British toy soldiers that he once brought me from London. And he was once married to, he used to be married to a beautiful Japanese lady. And so they always brought, you know, great goodies back home.
When did you visit the United States much?
Yeah, I think first time I visited the U.S., I was probably somewhere around 7, 8 years old when my parents, typically enough, put us in an airplane, and we all went to Disneyland.
Oh man! So if that's your first exposure to the U.S., you're thinking not a bad place.
Well, at that age, you probably think Disneyland is America.
Well, in some ways, it is. So you decided to tell us about going to college, though. You stayed in Mexico City for college?
I did. I basically grew up in Mexico City, and so stayed in Mexico City for college at a major Jesuit university, which is Universidad Iberoamericana.
What did you study there?
International relations, international politics. I had a very keen interest in public policy, in public affairs, and especially on international affairs. I wasn't really sure or, you know, determined that my future necessarily involved getting into the diplomatic corps. But I knew that something around there was what I was looking for.
Did you consider possibly a job somewhere domestically in public affairs?
My generation of my peers who graduated from the university, we were about 40, 40 people. And out of those 40, I believe I'm the only one who actually joined the diplomatic corps. Not necessarily the most successful one.
Well, when did you decide that you wanted to be a diplomat?
I was doing my master's degree after I studied in Mexico City. I decided we went and did a master's in England, in Canterbury, England, University of Kent. So I was over there doing my master's degree, and I received a, I will never forget it, I received a fax. Fax was still used.
Remember those?
Then.
Yeah.
I'm that old. So we received the fax. I received the fax from a good college professor of mine who happened to be working at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and he was basically giving me information of this announcement that was being made that there were openings to join the Foreign Service, and he basically made a convincing argument that I should, you know, try it out.
You did? What was your first posting? What was your first mission?
My first mission after 3 years, 3 years after I joined the Foreign Service, was in Australia.
Not a lot of border, not a lot of border crossings there.
No, not at all. Totally different situation of what I've been doing the past few years.
Well, so what was it like there to be the Consul General in Australia for Mexico?
Well, I wasn't the Consul General in Australia. Mm. I was a lowly second secretary back then. So my job in the Embassy of Mexico in Australia was basically to produce reports to Mexico City on the political happenings in a couple of countries which were part of the circumscription there, Fiji and Papua New Guinea, and I would follow up economic and political issues in terms of the bilateral relationship between Australia and Mexico. So I was, you know, right at the start of my career.
Now, I know you've got a story to tell about a tall ship race in Sydney that that you saw that was a, sort of a part of your diplomatic education, I guess, in some ways.
I had a posting in Australia for about a three-year posting there and some pretty unforgettable moments. But as a Mexican over there on the other side of the world, I always say that one of the most important events that I had a chance to witness was a tall ships race that happens every year. There's a tall ships race between the Sydney Harbour and Tasmania, Hobart, Tasmania. And it's a gorgeous event because you can imagine Sydney Harbour is filled with these gorgeous ships. So that year, a Mexican Navy tall ship was invited to participate, and it's part of the Mexican Navy. It's called the Cuauhtémoc, which is a training ship for Mexican sailors. And so this ship came into Sydney Harbour. It set up in a gorgeous place right next to the bridge, and they offered a reception there on a gorgeous summer night. And this is one of those things that stays with you for the rest of your life.
Yeah. So as well, though, so you're there, you're writing reports, you're looking across the harbor to Tasmania. Mm-hmm. And then you find yourself in San Diego. Was that next? San Diego from
after three and a half years in Australia, which was my first posting, and by the way, was I always think of it as also my our diaper changing years, because that's where we had babies. Mm-hmm. We came back to Mexico for about a year, and then I was sent for my first posting, official posting in the United States in San Diego. And that's a tremendous difference.
What? There are a lot of border crossings there.
Quite a few.
It's a huge difference.
Quite a few. Actually, the busiest border crossing point in the world.
Tijuana is south of the San Diego border. So that is an entirely different. So what did you find yourself doing there?
Well, when I was posted in San Diego, my position was the deputy consul general. So I was basically second in charge in the Mexican consulate in San Diego. And I had to do with supervising and overseeing every single operation of the consulate. Now, it's a very complex operation in any consulate, but I would probably say San Diego is one of our most complex of all because of the, again, like we already mentioned, of the presence of the issue of the border right next. Right. The busiest border in the world. Which generates a lot of activity, a lot of good things, some problems too. But the key element for the Mexican consulate in San Diego is to be in a position to have a reactive relationship with institutions on both sides of the border to make sure that we are able to respond whenever it's needed quickly to make sure that any problem doesn't get bigger than it should.
Well, you can find yourself in a situation like that, I would think, visiting hospitals, people who are hurt, perhaps in border crossings. Mm-hmm. So they might be involved in activities that we would consider illegal. And yet you're the representative of Mexico and their country. Tell us about that. And were you in situations where you'd visit people in hospitals and other jails, I suppose?
Okay. We constantly visited people who were detained or in jails or under supervision of authorities. So our role, of course, is not to question authorities in terms of they being able to do their job. Our job is basically to make sure that whoever is under their supervision has access to the law, that they have access to proper defense, and that they have full knowledge of their situation. And if it is possible, and if it is part of the situation for them to be able to defend their case.
In a situation like that, particularly in a city like San Diego, where there are so many border crossings, you're so close. Do you have to have a relationship with we talked about your relationship with the state of North Carolina, right? Mm-hmm. With the city itself, city officials, police and others. I mean, how does that work? They have to let you in. You have to have, it seems to me, a working relationship and yet a difficult position to be in to offer these kinds of services and information to people if the authorities are less than willing. That could be a tough job.
Well, firstly, it always involves having a good approach towards local authorities, having a good approach and good conversations with them, so them to understand what is the extent of our job and what is not the extent of our job, mm-hmm. because there's also a lot of misconceptions on that. So that we are here and our role is to facilitate and to help. And to help, yes, Mexican nationals, like you very well say, but it's our role is also to help authorities, American authorities, to be able to engage and to approach these communities in the scope of them being able to do their jobs. Mm-hmm. So we are we see ourselves as an instrument, as a tool that can be used both by Mexican nationals but also by local authorities.
Now, you were in San Diego before, during, and after 9/11, right?
Correct. Actually, I was in San Diego on the day of 9/11.
On the day. So how did things change afterward for you?
Of course, the first few days, the first few hours and days after 9/11, it was dramatic in the border region. The border almost practically shut down. And that generated tremendous situation and tremendous, suffering for people on both sides of the border who were used to having that sort of thing. Slowly, things started changing. American institutions changed too because of 9/11, as we all know. But especially, the way the border was enforced changed dramatically from that day on. And we had to work very strongly, very closely with federal and state and local authorities on both sides of the border to make sure that we were able to work together in this new environment better.
It's an interesting issue that you raise here. There's so many questions about securing our border for national security reasons. Mm-hmm. It is clear that we can shut down the border. We don't. I mean, is there a practical way, if you think about, again, 12 million people in this country from Mexico, it seems as though there would be some kind of economic demand, particularly if you're undocumented. You have to be working. There's nothing else you can do to stay here. Is it a practical thing even to talk about shutting down a border, closing a border to
immigration? Well, for anybody who's lived in the border, I did that for about 5 years. Shutting down the border is something that could be unheard of for people who actually live in the border. And then you probably would start having, we need to start having a more conversation of, like, let's define exactly what we mean by shutting the border. Shutting down the border doesn't mean, putting up a high fence and impeding anything going back and forth from both sides. From the most rational, proposals of when the border, when this sort of thing is mentioned, it means basically shutting down the border means making sure that people and goods that cross from one side to another do it in an orderly and legal way. And that we are able to work together to make sure that those that are not orderly and legal happen at the minimum rate possible, or not at all, if possible. Now, over 1 million people cross the U.S.-Mexico border legally every single year. 1 million, and which means that we are doing a lot of that every single day, and it's working pretty well. every single day. Our trade relationship is over $500 billion per year, which means more than $5 million per minute are being traded between Mexico and the United States. And a lot of that trade goes through the border. Not all of it, but a lot of that goes through the border, which means that the border works well if you consider all of that in many ways.
So trade is working, money is going back and forth, and of course we allow capital to go across the border without any impediment at all. That is what is called, you know, sort of free trade. What should have gone along with that is if the theory holds that the best trade is the freest, unfettered trade, labor should have that same right. If a dollar can fly the border and find its best possible use in Mexico, why can't a worker find his or her best possible earning power in the United States, if that's where it happens to be?
Yeah, when NAFTA was being negotiated, both all three countries in the region decided to leave labor out of the component. We think that it's, you know, it's an issue that's been there on the table, and it will not go away. North America is a region in which we share increasingly a manufacturing process. We are building a manufacturing goods together for quite a few years. But the linkages between our countries are so strong that we need to start thinking about our region as a whole towards the future. If you look other parts in the world, if you look to Europe or South America or Asia, many countries in Asia, they already are competing in global markets as regions. We do so in real terms. North America does so in real terms. We just don't perceive ourselves as a region, as North Americans. And it's a big issue that we will need start to be discussing in the future. Now, you know, the free flow of people in North America is a moving target. It changes. For quite a few years, especially, as you know, during the 80s and 90s, the flows of people coming into North America, into the United States from Mexico were huge, probably historical. But that has, as you already pointed out, changed dramatically. Mexicans are not coming to the United States anymore. They haven't been doing it for more than 3 years. For more than 3 years, detentions of the U.S. Border Patrol in the border are mainly Central Americans, not Mexicans. And things are changing. Why is this happening? You know, and of course, you know, that could be another one-hour conversation, but a lot of people would probably, you know, pinpointed, of course, the economy. The American economy has not regained its growth the way it had in the 90s. So if you take that basic premise into account, that would lead you to think that whenever the American economy resumes its growth, then immigration will kick up again. But there are other factors in place. Other factors in place, such as demographics. Mexican demographics are changing dramatically. Our country is urban. People live in cities, which means, among many other things, that we have less babies. And we have been doing that for quite a few years already. So demographers in Mexico estimate that the population in Mexico will cease to grow somewhere in the next decade, which means that Mexico probably will not have within our lifetimes again the amount of young people in the labor force that will be needed to supply the American economy the way we've been doing it for the past 20
years. So you've
got
a slow-growing American economy that is an economy which is less attractive to people who live in Mexico, a slow-growing population in Mexico, meaning less pressure within Mexico to move elsewhere to find work. And also, I guess, you know, part of this, too, is that as the economy changes, people living in urban areas. But one of the more interesting things to me in the Pew report shows people moving back to Mexico from the United States, whole families. At least half of those are voluntary. Others are being forced back through immigration. But of the population moving back, half of those are voluntary. There must be good reason to go back to Mexico.
Well, you know, I mean, for many years, there was the perception that migration was a circular phenomenon, that people who would come here to the United States from Mexico would come here and work for a while, keep their families back home, and then eventually return. That ceased to be the case somewhere in the mid-80s, probably. That's when it started happening, when the migration stopped being a circular phenomenon. And so instead of having like the typical single male coming over here, working in the fields or working in construction, sending money back home, etc., they started bringing their families. So that's when we saw in the late 80s, beginning of the 90s, large amounts of women and children coming over from Mexico to the United States, because it was a family reunification phenomenon going on. Nowadays, the phenomenon is totally different, and we've seen something that we never saw before. We've seen families that are deciding to go back to Mexico, amongst other things, because they might not be able to find the economic opportunity they were looking for here. But amongst other things is that they might have reason to believe that those opportunities might be present in Mexico.
We'll talk more about that with my guest, Javier Diaz de Leon, the Consul General of Mexico to North and South Carolina. Our conversation continues on The State of Things. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, talking this hour with Javier Diaz de Leon, Consul General of Mexico to North and South Carolina with an office in Raleigh. And we're talking about this net zero migration from Mexico. We're seeing a lot of immigration, of course, from Central America. But as many people are going back as are coming over the border from Mexico these days, and just before the break, you said part of the reason families are going back is they perceive greater opportunities in Mexico. Now, I know one of the promises of NAFTA, of course, was that there would be more manufacturing and that this would mean, you know, good things for Mexican industries. Some of those industries have prospered, but GDP hasn't gone up. And it just seems to me that and by all the research, for the average worker, life has not gotten better. And for the average Mexican, life has not gotten better. If you industry owners may have profited by this. Is there a net gain? Are there real opportunities, better economic opportunities now?
Well, in a larger sense, part of the process that we're talking about, the larger urban population in the country, has to do with that same story. A lot of people who worked in certain sectors of the economy, mainly in like rural agricultural areas, that saw themselves not competitive anymore within the open market system, had to move to other areas, other parts, which usually meant moving to cities. We know and we understand very well, for example, that one of the greatest challenges for any economy that opens up to the world, like the Mexican economy did, is to be able to be to transition a lot of these industries that are not competitive anymore into, and those people, those workers, to transition into other areas that represent opportunities. So in that sense, what Mexico has been watching since seeing is an emerging service and urban industry linked to construction, but mostly linked to the service parts of the economy. And the idea, of course, to generate a lot more opportunities and a lot more growth to the generation of a burgeoning middle class. This means, among other things, that there are certain parts of the economy, that part of the economy that's been able to hook into the global economy, has been great winners, have benefited greatly from this transition. But there are other sectors of the economy who are lagging behind. And that's the greatest, challenge that Mexico is facing. How are we able to get to make sure that income, that generation of enormous wealth that is generating in certain part of the country or certain parts of the economy, to trickle down to other parts that are being, a little relegated from the process?
Well, I'll talk to you more about that, but I want to make sure that we're sort of comparing apples and apples here. I mean, again, if you go back to NAFTA and the whole free trade impetus, I mean, one of the things that we noticed happening right off the bat was that American agricultural products, which were subsidized, went into Mexico and were displacing then. And so huge numbers of exports from the United States, imports into Mexico, were displacing Mexican farmers, which of course made it possible for them to move into factories that were now paying the lowest possible wage, because again, capital is free to find its best return on investment, which always means low wages. Is that a net gain? I was forced off my farm because of cheap American corn, and now I've got this ill-paying factory job. My life hasn't gotten
too much better. Absolutely. I mean, and no country in the world could or should base its development model on cheap wages. If you put in the context of certain industries between the United States and Mexico, of course, I mean, wages in Mexico will definitely always be lower. But at the end, there is an absolutely conviction, and we know very well that we will not be able to reach higher levels of lifestyle for the common population if the Mexican economy and Mexican wages don't appreciate a lot more than they have. So Mexico, for example, is competing nowadays for a lot of world markets with China, and we are not basing our advantages on having a wage war with China to see who makes it cheaper. That would be suicide. The strategy of Mexico is how are we able to position ourselves in certain manufacturing processes or certain activities that give us that we have a clear advantage of because of investment, because of development, because of invention of new processes, and of course also because of access to markets that maybe China doesn't have. And that brings me back to the model of thinking about how are we going to think of North America as a region and to be able to compete in world markets as part of this region.
That does suggest, at least part of that, suggests the development of a middle class. You referred to that earlier, to build better infrastructure, a better educated population that could position you to make better products, not just cheaper products.
No,
and that's
yeah.
one of the ways that you can develop an advantage. But that also suggests domestic policies that are going to support public domestic policies that would support things like education and the emergence of a middle class.
And that's a lot of what's you probably hear a lot about what's going on in Mexico with this enormous and this very important reforms to a lot of key sectors in the Mexican law and the Mexican economy going on in the past year, which involve key reviews of things such as important as energy, as telecommunications, as the labor system in Mexico, and education, of course. An educational system that is not in a position to provide better prepared workers or better prepared people for the workforce is an educational system that is failing the country. Mm. And we are going through a transition of system that used to respond to other priorities in the past.
And those priorities had to do with, generally speaking, corporate priorities in particularly monopolistic sectors, energy for one. The same thing's going on in this country, so it's nothing new.
In the case of Mexico, it's different because, a lot of the educational system in Mexico for many years had a lot to do also with benefiting certain privileges from the labor unions and privileging the certain power and political interests in many states of the country, which had a lot to do more with control and a lot with political control and less and less with educational efficiency and quality of education.
Also, we mentioned that most of the migration now from a Latino population is coming from Central America. It is going through Mexico and is creating social problems there as well. And I guess if we're looking at it from that point of view, how has the Mexican government responded to that? And again, fair treatment of the immigrants it finds in Mexico. Fair labor practices, are they enforced
Correct.
In Mexico for Hondurans and Salvadorans who find themselves
and
in Mexico?
We are very aware that we need to be consistent and, with whatever we are advocating for our nationals in the United States, we need to be consistent in what is going on for, in this case, Central American migrants that are going through Mexico or going to Mexico as migrants, as a destination country. So first thing we did a few years ago is that we changed the migration law in Mexico to make it consistent. It is not, for example, now a crime in Mexico to be undocumented in Mexico. It is an administrative, issue that needs to be resolved and that they are detained. And we also enforce our immigration law. And we also send back to Central America people who are undocumented in Mexico. But we have changed our laws to make sure that at least under the law, these people are treated fairly. That they are given a chance to defend their cases, that they are given access to their consular authorities of their countries, and if they are going to be sent back, that happens in an orderly and humane way.
Was that difficult to do politically? Change, decriminalize essentially undocumented?
It is always complicated. There are always hurdles because there are always people who think that the solution is to, you know, enforce laws in a different way. We probably in the case of Mexico, probably more than many other countries in the world, we have seen this, and we in other places. So changing our laws and changing the way we were dealing with, it did involve some local resistance, but at the largest sense, it would be pretty fair to say that the largest amount of Mexicans understand and know that we need to be consistent with what we are advocating.
What changes would you like to see in a U.S. immigration law?
First of all, we think U.S. immigration law must be decided by Americans and not by Mexico. But we do think, and Mexico has been saying this for quite a few years, that we need to work together in the region, as part of a region that we share, to find solutions that work for all of our countries. Americans must decide that. However, we do think, pretty much like the President of the United States says, that the current regime is not working. It is a regime that doesn't work either for those who are against immigration, and it doesn't work also for those who are for immigration. So a better system that deals with the historical linkages between our countries, the large amount of families that we share between the United States and Mexico, and the connections that we have within each other in terms of our economies, should be consistent with what is in place.
Well, so what does that look like on the ground? As we say, 12 million people here from Mexico, about half undocumented. It seems like a terribly impractical project to send everybody home. And we don't know what impact that would have on the economy. We're only talking about Mexico here, not the entire immigration picture.
Well, you're talking only about Mexico. For example, things that a lot of people, I think, in Mexico, but maybe in the United States, sometimes don't grasp. Yes, there are 12 million people in the United States who are undocumented. Half of those are Mexican, but half of those are not Mexican, which is, you know. And most of the people who are undocumented in the United States did not come through the border, which is also very important. It's mostly not a border issue. Most of the people who are undocumented in the United States are here because they overstayed their visas, but they didn't cross through the border with a trafficker, mm-hmm. which is the common, you know, right. the common image in most people's minds. Mm-hmm. First of all, so that's very important. Coming back to the Mexicans, you know, 12 million people were born in Mexico are living now in the United States, half of them without documents, yes. That means, to put it in context, one of every 10 Mexicans in the world, and one of every 10 Mexicans is in the United States. Now, if you think about the children of those first-generation migrants who are in the United States, we're talking about somewhere around 32 million people who are of Mexican origin who are right now in the United States. Most of them American citizens, but of Mexican origin. Now, 32 million comes up to somewhere about 10% of all Americans. So again, like I was saying before, one of every 10 Mexicans is in the United States, but also one of every 10 Americans is of Mexican origin. And that's pretty powerful.
Well, yeah, which argues well for sitting down and working this thing out. You can't honestly imagine just sending everybody home just because you don't have papers. It couldn't possibly work. And the impact it's having on our economy as well as our social and cultural institutions.
So you're talking about millions of people who are here with their families, with children who are Americans. And so the thing is, how can we work together? How can we, Mexico, be a positive factor to help the United States in this process to make sure that these people who are here, some of them might want to go back to Mexico, like you already mentioned, some are doing it, but many of them probably don't. So in that process, we want to be a part of a solution for the United States and for Mexico to make sure that the future of those people is bright, and it will be bright. It's just a thing of whether we're going to be part of the process with them.
I wonder how this compares to San Diego. North Carolina, certainly not on a border with Mexico, and yet has a very large net migration from Latino population is now growing, one of the largest immigrant populations or largest growth in immigrant population in the country, and not on a border. How does it compare being here to a place like San Diego where you're sharing a border with?
Well, it's a totally different issue, of course, because in places like California, Texas, or in the border, like the one I had the chance of experience. You're talking about places in which migration has been historical, and the Latino, Hispanic presence is historical. It's everywhere. However, here in North Carolina, you know, it's I always say it's probably like a 20-year story. I used to come to North Carolina when I was a kid. My parents used to send me to spend summer in Charlotte with a wonderful family. And first time I came to Charlotte, I was about 11 years old. Back then, you know, in the mid-70s in Charlotte, there were no Mexicans in Charlotte. I was like a very weird thing there. And my American family in Charlotte used to like show me around saying, I have a Mexican at home, you know. I mean, things have changed that much. Now, you know, North Carolina is among the top 15 states in terms of Latino population in the United States, which is amazing. A rate growth of immigration, mostly Latino, Hispanic, of over 400% in the past 4 years. Which means a dramatic change. Some of those changes are, challenging, very challenging. Challenging for the migrants themselves, of course, but it's also challenging for the local authorities. Because, among other things, the recent immigration such as that generates a situation in which immigrants are disenfranchised, in which immigrants are very lowly organized amongst themselves. There are not enough leadership among them. And again, brings me back to what we were talking about a few minutes ago. They lack a lot of information. So they tend to be segregated from the rest of society because of fear, again, lack of information about what's available, what the city, how it works, how American institutions work. And that generates a lot of issues and problems for all sides.
What a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much for being with us on the program today.
It's been an honor. Thank you.
Javier Diaz de Leon is the Consul General of Mexico to North and South Carolina. His office is in Raleigh. You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. Tomorrow, we're going to be at the Triad Stage in Greensboro for our monthly live program from that location, and you can join us if you'd like. You can send an RSVP to our website, stateofthings.org, and be in the audience when we're live from Greensboro tomorrow. State of Things is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Hadi Mawagdi, and Will Michaels. Our intern is Alex Curley. Our technical director is Robin Copley. WUNC's news director is Brent Wolf. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.